From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. This week, President Trump promised to wipe out the deadliest overdose epidemic in U.S. history.
We are going to end the scourge of drug addiction in America. We are going to end it, or we are going to at least make an extremely big dent in this terrible, terrible problem.
This terrible, terrible problem claimed 72,000 lives last year, two-thirds of those lives lost to opioids. Lives like those of Madeline Linsenmeyer, who first tried OxyContin at a party at 16 years old and died at 30. Her sister's powerful and poignant obituary went viral. So did the response from a Vermont police chief who has dedicated himself to combating this plague. This hour on Point, a grieving sister, a small city law enforcement official, and a deep dive into the people affected by this crisis. We want you to join us as well. And I have a special request this hour. I'd like to hear from listeners who themselves have been affected by this addiction and this epidemic, those who struggle with abuse of opioids, and those who struggle to help those who are addicted. We'd like you to please join in. You can participate anytime through our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us first from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania's Kate O'Neill. Her sister, Madeline Linsenmeyer, died October 7th. She was 30 years old and first tried OxyContin as a teenager. A relationship with opiates that would dominate the rest of her life, O'Neill wrote in her sister's moving obituary. You can find a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Kate O'Neill, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, in your tribute to your sister, to Madeline, you wrote, it's impossible to capture a person in an obituary, and especially someone whose adult life was largely defined by drug addiction. To some, Maddie was just a junkie. When they saw her addiction, they stopped seeing her. And what a loss for them. Because Maddie was hilarious and warm and fearless and resilient. What made you decide in your tribute to talk so expressly and directly about her addiction itself?
You know, it honestly didn't even occur to me not to talk about that. Like I said, it was part of what defined her adult life. It didn't define her, but it defined a lot of how she lived her life. She was, you know, in the times that she was in sobriety, she was struggling to stay there. And when she wasn't in sobriety, she was living in a lot of darkness. So I wanted her obituary to reflect both the love and the light that she brought into the world and also the darkness that she and so many people experience as a result of this disease.
Madeline Linsenmeyer's family always said she loved music, that she was a born performer who had a singing voice so beautiful it would stop people on the street, as Kate wrote in her obituary. When she shared her voice, she shared her light. I'd like to play a little clip of her singing Bonnie Raitt's I Can't Make You Love Me.
'Cause I can't make you love me if you don't. I'll close my eyes. And then I won't see the love that is there right in front of me. And I don't remember the rest of the words.
Oh.
A moment of humor here. Kate O'Neill, tell me a little bit about who Maddie was.
You know, Maddie, I think that clip actually tells you a lot. She was earnest and had a beautiful singing voice. She was a pleasure to be around and a great sense of humor. You know, she loved her family so much, and we loved her in return. And to see her, the descent that she experienced as a result of her addiction has been so, so painful. And, you know, right up until the end, she fought it and brought all of those beautiful qualities into our lives, as well as a lot of fear and despair, which, again, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are experiencing.
Her death, obviously, at young age, with, leaving behind a young son, was a loss out of joint, out of time. What did she need from your standpoint?
I mean, I think from the beginning she needed, I think people need an understanding of what a prescription opiate-based painkiller does and can do. You know, she took a pill at a party having no idea. And then when she became addicted, access to services, you know, we live in Vermont and, you know, she would often, you know, it was a two-hour drive across the state to get to a rehab. And, you know, I remember one time driving her those, it's actually closer to 3 hours. And when we got there, the bed that she had been promised wasn't available. And And we were told it was going to be a week before it was. You know, medication-assisted treatment, I think, is key. So access to buprenorphine and methadone. You know, Maddie had to stand in line for methadone every day, which makes it incredibly difficult for people to lead lives, have jobs. Mm-hmm. And then services when people leave treatment so that they are, you know, reacclimated and supported as they try to stay sober.
Kate O'Neill's tribute to her sister, Madeline, inspired a response, and a strong one, an appreciative one. This is from Burlington's police chief, Brandon Del Pozo. That's from Burlington, Vermont. He wrote that he had a problem with the obituary. And then he wrote, "Why did it take a grieving relative with a good literary sense to get people to pay attention for a moment and shed a tear when nearly a quarter of a million people have already died in the same way as Maddie as this epidemic grew? Did readers think this was the first time a beautiful, young, beloved mother from a pastoral state got addicted to oxy and died from the descent it wrought? And what about the rest of the victims who weren't as beautiful and who lived in downtrodden cities or the Rust Belt? They too had mothers who cried for them and blamed themselves." We are joined now from the studios of Vermont Public Radio in the town of Colchester is Chief Brandon Del Pozo himself. And thanks so much for joining us here on Point for this discussion, Chief.
Hi, David, and hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Talk to me a little bit about your response, about what impelled you to publicly share your feelings of conflict over what Kate had written about her sister.
Yeah, and to be clear, I didn't have any conflict with what Kate wrote. I thought it was beautiful, and I thought that there should have been countless obituaries written that way. When Mayor Murrow Weinberger appointed me chief of police in September of 2015, the first thing he said at the podium that day was, I'd like my chief of police to help the city turn the tide on the opioid crisis. That was a mandate that I took seriously. It involved a lot of learning, a lot of research. I was not a public health professional. I'm still not. Chief of police is my role. But when I saw that obituary, I started following it more closely, its path through the world, because we were going to talk about Maddie at our opioid policy meetings. And the breaking point for me, as I've said a few times now, is when it got picked up by People magazine, because People does not stay in business by dealing with difficult topics. And this is one of the most difficult ones in America. And when it did, I said, this is what it took, right? There's a quarter of a million obituaries that could have been written before this, all for human beings who took this path in life and who left pain and loss behind. And People magazine wrote this obituary. That was, you know, where I got my rancor up a little. And I wrote it actually, I was trying to fall asleep, and I wrote it as a Facebook post in bed at about 11:30 at night. And I hit send with a little bit of not trepidation. I just thought it would go to a few thousand Facebook friends, but it went much further.
I want to take a call from Lexington, Kentucky. Ronald, go ahead.
Hello. My name is Ronald. I've been a nurse for 25 years. When we first started, opioids, especially ones people get addicted to, were limited to terminal cancer patients only. It was never given for acute illnesses, you know, like an injured leg or a dental problem. While I know you guys are talking about people who've died, I think you should talk about all the people who become addicted each day to opioids, especially prescription pain medicines. Mm-hmm. While they may not die, they die of other things like hepatitis, they die of respiratory diseases, or they waste away, not to mention their lives are ruined, especially young kids and children who are still exposed to opioids from family members or from people who are selling their drugs to get other people high, which is a huge industry still yet in America.
So Ronald, I appreciate that very much. Let's let some of our people discussing this with us address that. Kate, what do you make of what Ronald had to say about those who get sick and get addicted as opposed to those who simply die?
I mean, I think, you know, death is the end result for so many people who are addicted, and I completely agree. I mean, my sister was addicted for 12 years. We're talking about her now after her death, but she lived that addiction for 12 years. And she did have hepatitis C. She did, you know, I mean, I think among the many things we have to talk about is treatment. We need to talk about people, keeping people safe. So harm reduction, meeting people where they are in their recovery process or in their use. But I completely agree. That number is staggering. 50,000 people last year dying from opioid overdoses alone. And it doesn't include my sister's death. And it doesn't include, you know, so many people who die from causes related to their use. And it doesn't include all the people who struggle every day. As a result of this obituary, my family has received an huge outpouring of letters and emails and comments on my sister's obituary from people who have daughters and mothers and sons and brothers and uncles who are struggling every day.
You know, it was just 1 year ago today that President Trump declared the opioid epidemic a national public health emergency. Under that designation, no federal funds were actually automatically directed to the crisis, but federal agencies were encouraged to direct more grant money to combating the epidemic. Here's what he had to say.
Our current addiction crisis, and especially the epidemic of opioid deaths, will get worse before it gets better. But get better it will. It will take many years and even decades to address this scourge in our society. But we must start in earnest now to combat national health emergency.
You've been hearing this hour and will continue to hear Kate O'Neill told the story of her sister's death from an addiction to the death to her addiction to opioids. And of course, to Burlington, Vermont, Chief of Police Brandon Del Pozzo, who I will ask a little bit about the steps he's taken in his city to try to address this scourge. We're talking about the opioid crisis, the lives ended, the lives ruined, and the lives changed forever by this drug epidemic. We'd like you to join the conversation. And as I said earlier, I'd especially like to hear from addicts and those who try to help them. How confident are you that a new federal law will make a difference, as President Trump and politicians of both parties say? What's working where you live? What's not working where you live? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're exploring the opioid crisis this hour by talking to people most affected by it. You can join the conversation. What do you find works? Medication-assisted treatment? Abstinence-only and 12-step programs? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Kate O'Neill, who wrote a stirring obituary for her sister, who passed away after spending more than a decade struggling with addiction, and Brandon Del Pozzo, the chief of police in Burlington, Vermont. Chief Del Pozzo, you've called this one of the priorities of your time there, directed that way by the mayor of Burlington. What steps have you taken there?
So one of the things we realized right away, the mayor and I, is that we couldn't just take a policing approach. And if you're wondering why a chief of police got this job of addressing the opioid crisis, it's because most American cities don't have a Department of Health, right? We're either relying on county government, which we don't have much of in Vermont, or state government to provide a solution. But at the end of the day, it's local governments and their collaborations with hospitals and addiction services providers that have to come up with an answer to turn this tide. It's the number one source of accidental death in our society today, period, no matter how you cut it. What we did was learn about opioid addiction. And one of the things we came away with is that although it's an imperfect solution, that unlike crystal meth or unlike crack cocaine, other drugs, there are medicines that interrupt the cravings and withdrawal and the urges in the human body for heroin and fentanyl that don't exist for these other drugs. And they are, like Kate said, buprenorphine, methadone. There's a lot of stigma around just the idea of medication-assisted treatment. But period, it saves lives. The evidence is irrefutable. And although it won't get us out of the spiritual malaise that some people say leads to drug addiction, it will lower the mortality rate. We could take a deep breath and we could move forward. So what the mayor directed is that we do everything we can to get every opportunity to put people into medication-assisted therapy. As of late, at our needle exchange, if you were to walk in to get some clean syringes and say, I'm not ready for treatment, but you wanted to try some of the medication, you'll get a prescription for it. And that prescription is written by a doctor a doctor who lost a son to opioid overdose. If you go to our emergency department with an overdose, instead of just being made conscious again and being kicked out the door, hey, we saved your life, but you still have the problem, which is what happens in nearly every emergency department in America, you can get a prescription for buprenorphine and a 72-hour appointment with an addiction psychiatrist. That's a new pilot. And we worked very hard in Vermont, from Mayor Murrow Weinberger up to Governor Scott, to get legislation in place that mandates medication-assisted therapy for every prisoner in our prison system who needs it. And I'll say briefly that if you look at that model in Rhode Island, which made a commitment to getting every prisoner in its prison system who needs it the right medication, the right time, they reduced post-incarcerative overdose deaths by 62%, by two-thirds. In fact, they're down in Rhode Island 12% as of last year in overdose deaths. Two-thirds of that reduction, two-thirds of that 12%, 8% of it is just due to what they've done in their prisons. And in Vermont, we're trying all these things, and hopefully they'll turn the tide.
Kate O'Neill, would this have helped Maddie and people like her?
I mean, I believe it would. Maddie's been incarcerated multiple times and never received medication-assisted treatment while in prison. You know, I think Burlington is an incredibly special place, really progressive. I think it could lead the country in responding to this. But, you know, the fact that it is a law enforcement issue is a problem, that it's being treated that way. This is a public health issue. So if it's being treated, you know, our jails are the biggest opportunities for rehabilitation in this country right now, and we need to act on that. But we need to step back. This is a public health issue, and Vermont, again, is doing a great job, and I think a lot of these measures would have been helpful. Treatment is still a huge issue in a lot of rural states, you know, where this epidemic is occurring. You know, you have to drive hours to get there. What if you don't have a car, you know? And then the programs are 21-day, 28-day, often abstinence-based programs, you know. So there's a lot of issues. And I do think that Burlington and, you know, Chief Del Pozo will be leading this, and I appreciate that. But more needs to be done.
I just want to be clear. When you talk about abstinence-based, which is another way of describing some of the things like 12-step, you're saying that's not actually always helpful for folks, right? I mean, because in popular culture, for people who don't struggle with addiction, they may think, well, that's going to get them on a good path, or it's easily enough done.
Yeah, I think, you know, Brandon just referred to this. There's a lot of stigma around medication-assisted treatment. And my family, when Maddie was first starting to get clean, had the idea, well, if you're taking methadone or if you're taking buprenorphine, well, you're not really clean. You're not sober, right? Mm-hmm. Which is just, you know, there's so much evidence that show that these treatments are the most effective way to treat this disease. And so denying people access or making it difficult for them to have access to it, you know, I think, you know, if you have an issue where you have diabetes, we don't say to people, you know what, like, you can't have this drug that would help you get better. And we make it difficult for people to get this drug that would make them get better. And there's a stigma around that within the recovery community, which I think is hard too.
And we're David,
please go ahead.
Please, no, I think it's important to even be more categorical about what Kate is saying. If we stick to an abstinence-based plan to help our way out of the opioid crisis, we are headed for unmitigated disaster. If somebody is hell-bent on being abstinent, we're behind them every step of the way. Clinically, if you look at that public health research and the medical research, abstinence fails well over 90% of the time as an intervention. It's the medicines that we have available to us that reduce these bad outcomes. I have a friend in my old town in the Hudson Valley who I did not know for years was a recovering heroin addict. I used to play with his kids. We used to go to social events together. And when I started doing this line of work, he said, Brandon, I've been on buprenorphine for a decade now, and it's the only reason why I'm healthy and alive. And that's not – I know that's an anecdote, but if you just look at the success rates, if anybody spent a few minutes looking at the success rates for abstinence versus the success rates for medicine when it comes to addiction, there's no question that abstinence as a population-level intervention to reduce mortality is a losing proposition. And we need to make these medicines available, and we need to overcome the stigma that surrounds taking a medicine to – right yourself, because we don't have that stigma when we recover from HIV, we give someone the AIDS cocktail. We don't have that stigma, as Kate said, when somebody has to take diabetes medicine for the rest of their life.
You know, we've been getting fascinating and strong response from listeners as the show's been going on. One, Paul Norton says, addiction's like a cancer. One does not choose to have either. He posted on our website on our Facebook page and wrote, addiction is a lifelong fight of a disease that few respect or realize can't be cured by jail or condemnation. Only love, respect, understanding, and radical forgiveness and patience can cure it. Another commenter on our website under the name Nearest9 wrote, I've had acute chronic pain for over 10 years. Opioids have kept me alive. They are the only reason I haven't killed myself due to endless horrible pain. These drugs keep it at least at the level where I can read, watch TV, etc., and get some website. I've tried so many non-drug treatments and non-opioid drugs, but nothing have helped. I will point out that we do have information on sites for dealing with addiction and also questions of dealing with self-harm or suicidal thoughts on our website at On Point Radio. You can Google for that. I want to take a call now from Norwich, Connecticut. Nadir, go ahead, please.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Okay.
Thank you for having me on. What the other gentleman just said just kind of threw me off, because you cannot put somebody who has diabetes, like my grandmother has had for 25 years, in the same category as someone, you know, who has an opioid addiction. I mean, there's more than one way in which people end up getting hooked on these things. A lot of times it happens from a mere accident, a car accident, and they're given a prescription. And after the fact, they end up becoming addicted to the medication. Some people, which either they don't need to take the medication anymore for pain, and some who do continue to need to take the medication for pain. My personal experience alone, in 10 years I've been in Norwich, I've lost about 9 people.
Mm-hmm.
Young kids, right out of high school, some of them. Some of them even got to see 30 years old, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a shame, because there's so many layers to this. It's not straightforward. I mean, there's a whole thing going on with the insurances, the insurance companies, and their kickbacks, and with these rehabilitation centers where they make a lot of money just for you to go to Stonington Institute here in Stonington, Connecticut. Once you're there for over 24 hours, the insurance company, the state, gets billed $14,000 automatically. You can walk in there and walk right out of there. And not to mention the level of the criminality of the thing.
You know, thank you so much for this, Nadir. I appreciate it. You know, layer upon layer, and we're getting call upon call about this. I want to go also to Washington Island, Wisconsin, with Nicola. Tell us what happened with your family.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling to sort of voice a thought on this, because my granddaughter has no father today because her father died of a heroin overdose.
Mm-hmm.
My own son is a recovering heroin addict.
Mm-hmm.
And in my son's case, he had a back injury. He received OxyContin. When they cut off his OxyContin, he couldn't deal with the pain felt he couldn't deal with the pain, so he turned to heroin. And I just wanted to echo what was said earlier by the guest, which is this is a public health problem. I've got a granddaughter now who doesn't have a father. This is a crisis that is hitting across all kinds of status in terms of economics, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And until we look at it as a public health crisis, we're not going to make any recovery. I will tell you, my own son struggled again and again trying to get help. And because he was uninsured, he could not get any treatment. And
Nicola, thank you for sharing this about your son's circumstances and about your family's circumstances. I wanted to ask Kate O'Neill, how hard was it for Maddie to be able to get help after she had relapses?
It was pretty tough. You know, there's often not beds. In Vermont, there's just a couple places to get treatment. You know, again, there was, you know, one 21-day program that she went to multiple times. 21 days is not enough time. Treatment needs to be long-term, and it needs to extend past the time that somebody is in a facility. And to go to the point of the person who just called in, this, you know, and the realization that my family had, which, you know, when you're in the middle and when you're in the throes of it with your own family, you're a little bit insulated from it. But I think Brandon also made this point in his piece that Maddie is very easy to empathize with. It's easy to have compassion for a freckle-faced young white woman. But when Maddie was in the throes of her disease, it was a lot harder to have compassion for her. And people all over the country who look all different kinds of ways have this disease. And I think compassion and empathy are key. We have that compassion and empathy for people who have other kinds of diseases. We need to have that for people who have addiction as well, regardless of whether, you know, where they are at in their disease process. If they're panhandling in the parking lot or sleeping on a piece of cardboard, we need to have empathy for those people.
Well, Kate O'Neill, thank you so much for sharing your story and for joining us today.
Thanks.
Coming online now from Austin, Texas, we have Beth Macy. She's an author and journalist whose latest book takes a comprehensive look at the opioid crisis. Her work stemmed in part from her reporting in Roanoke, Virginia. And her book is called Dope Sick: Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. You can read an excerpt of her book at her website, onpointradio.org. Beth Macy, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, David.
Beth, you've been listening to the show. Help us understand, why did this explode as an addiction problem? Opiates and opioids are not brand new to America. Why has it become such a big thing in more recent years?
Well, it started in the mid-90s with this idea, the introduction of OxyContin in 1996, and the idea being pushed by pharma and pharma-funded medical societies that pain was being undertreated. And so they flipped the narrative, which for 100 years we only used opioids in cases of cancer, end-of-life, severe pain. And between in just a few years, it went from cancer doctors being the biggest prescribers to now general doctors being the biggest prescribers of opioids. And this idea that it was okay now to take opioids for back pain, moderate pain, osteoarthritis, TMJ. And that's really kind of the crux of the seed of where this epidemic first took place.
That is a concerted effort to say that that pain was undervalued as something to address in a intense prescribed way, and that the way in which that was addressed were these increasingly strong drugs that were promised, as I read it in your book, were promised not to be addictive. That is a very rare notion of addiction because of the way in which it was time released. Why did that not turn out in your reporting to be true?
Well, they sent armies of sales reps into these communities, particular communities where there had been workplace injuries, unemployment was rising, disability was rising, and they pushed that notion. They paid 5,000 doctors, nurses, pharmacists to become paid speakers for the company. And then, you know, the company eventually in 2007 in federal court in Virginia admits that it is a criminally misbranded the drug. But the way the plea agreement works, they're allowed to continue selling the drug after the settlement. And in fact, sales of OxyContin increased.
Chief Pozo, you know, in your experience, how much has the question of OxyContin and this prescription drug played in as opposed to heroin, fentanyl, and other opiates?
So this isn't the first time that we've had an opioid epidemic in America. It's been going on for, you know, as long as the country's been around, just in cycles, right? Naked Lunch by William S. Burroughs goes back to 1959 and opioid use there. But when we're looking at this iteration now and why this became such an acute problem, everything we've seen is that it is indeed because of analgesic opioid painkillers. But what has happened is the demand for those painkillers, which has been the subject of scrutiny and regulation and, for example, laws in Vermont that carefully track how much doctors prescribe, that initial demand has awoken the black market, and the black market supplies things like heroin. It supplies things like fentanyl. And so what we're seeing now is as we're reining in prescription painkillers, for example, they're down, I think, something like 70% at the hospital here. We are seeing that demand replaced by the black market for things like heroin and fentanyl, which are just as lethal, if not more so.
We have a statement from Purdue Pharma, which is the manufacturer of OxyContin. They sent a few paragraph statement. But among the things they say is that Purdue Pharma is committed to addressing the opioid crisis as we support a number of public health policies designed to stem the tide of opioid-related addiction and limit prescribing. They said they've accepted responsibility for activities that occurred 16 years ago but are part of the solution rather than the problem for this troubling crisis. We, of course, are discussing the opioid epidemic and how it affects lives and how it affects communities across across the country. We want you to join the conversation, particularly if you've been affected. President Trump says he's going to make an extremely big dent in the opioid crisis. What will it take to do that? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're looking at the human cost of the opioid epidemic that's devastated our country. You can join the conversation. Who do you think is responsible for this devastating drug crisis? Big pharma? Law enforcement? Drugs pouring in from overseas? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Burlington, Vermont Police Chief Brandon Del Pozo and Beth Macy. She's the author and journalist whose latest book is titled Dope Sick: Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. I want to start with a couple of calls. They're kind of flooding in. I'd like to take a call first from Jada, calling in from Hartsville, South Carolina. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh. I wanted to hear a little bit.
I'm sorry?
I just wanted to hear what your thoughts were about all this.
Well, I am a recovering addict, and I don't think an addict ever is cured, because I think we're hardwired differently than normal people. You know, we're one Tylenol may be good for somebody. Five would be great for me. I hated pain medicine until I had oral surgery, and they gave me opiates, and all of a sudden I was in love. I thought this was heaven. I had kidney stones. Then they gave me IV drugs, and that was even better. I was like, God, heaven on earth, you know. And then they turn you loose back out into with a prescription, and then that's it, you know. And then you're out there on your own with your body fiending for more of what you can't get, and you'll do just about anything you can to get what you need.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that, Jada. We've also have a call from Boston, Massachusetts. Tom, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
Listen, I think the police chief from Vermont is right on, but I got to tell you, if the drug companies that were providing the medicated-assisted medication were pushing that drug as hard as Purdue Chemicals pushed the OxyContin, we wouldn't have a problem right now. And because the medication is effective, I'm a recovering addict, and I'm also a treatment provider, and I've been doing it for 28 years. And I've never seen anything like what I've seen over the last 10 years. You know, the pharmaceuticals were bad enough, but now that they're pulling back on the pharmaceuticals, the fentanyl is being flooded throughout the addiction, the heroin belt in Massachusetts anyway. And so what I'm seeing is I'm seeing people that are stabilized on medication, and then what happens is they taper off, and then they relapse and die. Because there's no just plain relapses anymore. It's just death. They get a shot of fentanyl, or they get the perk 30s that are really pressed fentanyl, and they get a couple of them and they die. Now, in my history, I was incarcerated because of my opiate dependence, and I relapsed the day I got out. Had that been me today, I'd be dead, because 10 to 20% of the population that are exiting prison that have addictive heroin histories die within the first 2 weeks. because of an overdose. So,
Tom, let the folks here weigh in on this, but thank you for sharing both your personal experience and also your expertise on this. But Macy, I want to let you weigh in on a couple things. First, you heard the statement a few minutes ago that I read from Purdue Pharma talking about how they are an active part of the solution, constructively engaging to find ways to remedy this and not currently part of the problem. How does that fit in with your reporting on this?
Well, it fits in that, you know, they've just have plans to create a new buprenorphine product, which is great. But if they really wanted to make a difference in America, they could do as Chief Del Pozo and others in some of the states that are finally starting to push back their overdose death rates by a very little bit and make it widely available. One of the things I wanted to point out by what about the chief and what's happening in Vermont is that's really unusual. I mean, my hat is just off to him. Mm-hmm. But in states where we were very slow to pass Medicaid, we just passed it in Virginia, became the 33rd recently. I mean, we have a resistant
police. Forgive me, but you're talking about Medicaid expansion, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, Medicaid expansion. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have waiting lists that range from 3 weeks to 2 years to get into MAT program. We have no funneling from our ERs into MAT programs. In my city of Roanoke, Virginia, we have a police chief that's come out against syringe exchange. So nowhere for somebody to go. We don't have any treatment in our jails. And, you know, it shouldn't be geographic. It shouldn't be the luck of where you live, whether you get this life-saving treatment or not.
Beth, we have a listener who wrote online. She wrote, "I believe the opioid crisis is a reflection of American culture. It's a disease of despair. Our culture is money-driven. There are a lack of opportunities for the majority of Americans." In your book, it seems to me that one of the themes that comes out is sort of the constriction of opportunities for Americans, particularly in the Rust Belt and in Appalachia, you know, stretching from the American Southeast up to the Northeast. In industries where they once could rely on steady jobs.
Exactly. And that's where, you know, the crisis first erupted in these distressed rural communities where the jobs were closing at the same time this pain is a fifth vital sign was being pushed. So what we really need are policies to address the root causes, which are mental health issues and socioeconomic despair. I mean, there's a kid in my book who's interviewed or one of his teachers asked him in middle school, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And he says, "I want to be a drawer." And she goes, "Oh, you want to be an artist?" And he goes, "No, I want to be a drawer. I want to draw Social Security disability," because that was the only thing he could imagine, because that's what he saw around him. In Lee County, which I write about in the book, it's heart of Central Appalachia, opioids were prescribed 300 to 600% of the national average. And there are 57% of men who are working age there who are unemployed.
Recently, the president has talked about the mobilization of the federal government to address the crisis. On Tuesday, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar said the U.S. is starting to turn the corner on this epidemic. He cited figures showing a 2.8% dip in overdeaths from September 2017 to March 2018.
According to provisional data from the CDC, the seemingly relentless trend of rising overdose deaths seems to finally be bending in the right direction. Plateauing at such a high level is hardly an opportunity to declare victory, but the concerted efforts of communities across America are beginning to turn the tide.
Brandon Del Pozo, you know, the number of Americans dying from opioid-related deaths appears to be just under the number of Americans in total who died in the Vietnam War. But is the secretary right? Are we turning the corner a bit on this?
Well, first of all, that's every year, right? So the Vietnam War was a 10-year war. And to, you know, this is every year we're losing the entire Vietnam War. And so I think it's such an unmitigated disaster at this point that he's right to point at a plateau. But if we're waiting for America to fix its spiritual malaise before we can see a change in the opioid crisis, then we're being derelict in our duties. And I do hope that there are politicians and community leaders that want to wrestle with unemployment and people's sense of value in their lives and communities. But if you're a mayor like Mayor Weinberger here in Burlington or a chief of police, police, you know, get down to brass tacks. There are things we can do today, right now, besides lowering the unemployment rate that will save lives. And I'd like to thank Beth for being so candid about them as well. I mean, it's getting the right treatment out there. It's getting medication to the people who need the medication. The 21-day abstinence-based detox is called the spin dry by a lot of the people addicted to opioids in Vermont, because you just go for your 21-day spin dry. And what it does is it gets the judge off your back, it gets your mom off your back, and then you just go quietly back to your home and you start using opioids again. That is not about hope and despair in America. That's about sound public health policies.
Beth, could you just take one moment and describe for us what opioids, just briefly, what opioids do to the brain? Why are they so dangerous?
Yeah. So once you get addicted to these drugs, it's people – I mean, I watch over and over in my book, people lose access to these life-saving treatments, and they are just not able to get better without the help of this medication-assisted treatment because of it's like they can't get enough dopamine going. And you know, they describe this excruciating withdrawal. They call it dope sickness. And that fear of – that sort of outsized fear of dope sickness is really what's leading them to keep continuing to use. It's not so much to get high, as someone in my book says early on. It's at the end of your journey, you're doing it not to get dope sick. And you just see these families are worn out by the behavior of these people who have stolen from them, you know, sons and daughters, much beloved, like Madeline and like my Tess, who I write about in the book. They're stealing. They're living homeless. They're prostituting. They will do anything for this drug. And one of the things Tess Henry told me when she first got addicted by being prescribed two opioids, 30-day opioids for a simple case of bronchitis at an urgent care center, she said, you know what we need is an urgent care for the addicted. And that's the way I see what Chief Del Pozo has going in Burlington with a syringe exchange where they are helping people avoid not having these waiting lists. They're getting them tested for hepatitis C, which Tess also had. They're getting them help when they come into the ER, not simply a Xerox of an AA and NA meetings, which she was so discriminated during.
Well, I mean, you can just hear from what you're describing what happens. We have people who are calling who themselves either are recovering addicts or have lost family members to the addiction. I want to take several of them right now quickly in order. Let's take a Francesca, perhaps, from Boston. Francesca, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, thank you for taking my call. Yes, I'm a bereaved mother. My son died from a drug overdose. He was addicted to OxyContin.
I'm so sorry.
And my question to the air has always been, why aren't the drug companies investing in treatment for the people that they've hooked on this drug? I don't understand why we're not demanding it, and I don't understand they should just do it on their own volition because it's the right thing to do. But I think we have to demand them to help.
Brandon Del Pozo, thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. Brandon Del Pozo, what role is Purdue Pharma or other major pharmaceuticals playing in this to help clean it up?
Yeah, right now one of our addiction centers, the Howard Center, is talking about, for example, Purdue's come out, as Beth said, with a formulation for buprenorphine that's a lot easier and safer and simpler to dose, and they stand to make a lot of money off of manufacturing it. It will definitely save lives. It's easier to implement in correctional settings, for example. So the irony is that if things continue status quo, Purdue Pharma, to be candid, I believe will have had a huge hand in creating this epidemic and profited from that. Then we'll profit from the medicines that get us out. That's not a reason not to use them. But the irony is that we may just have to sue their pants off to get the settlements that we then use to buy the drug that saves lives. Or, and here is where I'm out of my depth because I'm not a pharmaceutical manufacturer. But it would be great if they gave it away, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well,
I'm sure they and their flotilla of lawyers would have something to say if those suits came in. But it's interesting to hear that. We have some other calls. Aaron is calling from Detroit, Michigan.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Hi. I'm going to talk fast. I want to get all this in. I am a recovering person. I've been recovering for 31 years. The whole early part of my life was spent in opioid or heroin type addiction and whatever else I could get. I got clean in 1987. In 2004, I had back surgery, and the scar tissue that was generated by the surgery created pain that causes me to now have to take medication that I once wanted to take but now hated to take. And so I work with my primary care doctor and a pain clinic to get a combination of drugs that I could take a minimal amount without altering my mood to create a level of pain relief that would allow me to function. That has happened over a trial and era period of a couple of years. We have come up with a combination that doesn't alter me and doesn't put me in danger, and I can use the medication as prescribed a minimal amount. But now, because of this opioid crisis, people who are legitimately using and need of medications for normal functioning is now being put in the same category as those who abuse it, who I was once one of. And now my former self and those who were like me are now causing me to be traumatized by not being able to get the medications that I need now to function as a normal citizen.
Well, thank you so much, Aaron, for sharing that. I appreciate that as well. You know, Brennan Del Pozo, we've got a commenter online who tweets, what it took for the opioid crisis to hit white people recognized was to hit white people, because opioid addiction has been a crisis in the black community of Baltimore ever since I can remember. Briefly, Chief Del Pozo, you know, you're now in Burlington, Vermont, but you used to be a member of the New York Police Department here in New York, where I am right now. How much is there a racial component to the way in which public officials appear to be responding to this?
I think that what I'd like to do is give ourselves the benefit of the doubt, whether we deserve it or not, that we're doing this for the right reasons and that it's not inspired by a more palatable skin tone. But there will be a test, right? Right now, we're seeing that as the black market reawakens, it's hitting certain cities even harder, and that the demographic of death and overdose is shifting, for example, in New York from white women and men in Staten Island to brown skin, you know, black and Hispanic men and women in Brooklyn and the Bronx. That shift is happening, right? So we're going to see now with that, and then with the things like the, you know, the recurrence of crystal meth up in New England that's coming our way, will we be as enlightened and will we be as public health focused and will we be as creative in our solutions as we were when it was the quote unquote white person's problem? And, you know, we're committed to that here in Burlington, and we're going to abide by our principles. But it will be a test for the nation. I agree.
The president signing legislation embraced by members of both party this week into law, sort of a patchwork of efforts not seen as major legislation. But I guess we will be following this issue and revisit, see how well that does to address this issue. I want to also say thank you to all those who shared their stories, their own addiction stories of their family members, and remind them that if you or anyone you know is living with addiction or depression, we have resources available to help. You can check them on our website, onpointradio.org, for more information. You've been listening to Brandon Del Pozo. He's chief of police in Burlington, Vermont. Brandon, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you, David.
And we've also been talking to Beth Macy. She's author of Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. Thank you so much, Beth, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Madeline D'Angelo, Justine Daum, and Lexi Puri. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.